hppodcraft.com.
When the student of medicine, Richard Brackmont, decided to move into room number 7 of the small Hotel Stevens, three persons had already hanged themselves from the crossbar of the window in that room on three successive Fridays. The first was a Swiss traveling salesman. They found his corpse on Saturday evening. The doctor determined that the death must have occurred between 5 and 6 o'clock on Friday afternoon. The corpse hung on a strong hook that had been driven into the window's crossbar to serve as a hanger for articles of clothing. The window was closed, and the dead man had used the curtain cord as a noose. Since the window was very low, he hung with his knees practically touching the floor, a sign of the great discipline the suicide must have exercised in carrying out his design. Later, it was learned that he was a married man, a father. He had been a man of a continually happy disposition, a man who had achieved a secure place in life. There was not one written word to be found that would have shed light on his suicide, not even a will.
That is the opening of Hans Heinz Uhr's Die Spider, a story H.P. Lovecraft really liked a lot, so much so that he wrote about it in supernatural horror and literature.
Yeah.
And so we're going to talk about it today here on the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
We are here at hppodcraft.com. My name is Chad Pfeiffer.
And I am Chris Lackey.
And our reader, once again, is Caleb Hoffert. Caleb read for us last week, asked him back this week. He does voice work, so if you like what you're hearing, reach out to us and we'll put you in touch with Caleb for your audiobook project.
Heck yeah.
Or if you just want to have him do your answer machine message. Does anybody have an answering machine anymore? That's a little dated thing to say.
Yeah, it is.
Any kind of voice acting that you need, he's your man. He's our man this week, and we're glad to have him back on the show.
Darn tootin'.
This story, I panicked after we picked it last week.
What?
Because I started to read it, and I thought, oh no, has this finally happened? Have we covered something before and then completely forgotten that we did it?
No.
But no, we hadn't covered it before. But the reason that I thought we'd covered it was because this story is actually based on a story we've covered, and that was The Invisible Eye by that French pair. Remember Erckmann Chatrian?
Yep.
We covered it back in the summer of 2013, and we had a good time covering it, as I recall, because that was the guy who was in the room who hung himself, but there were like mannequins and he dressed up like an old woman.
Yep.
And it didn't make any sense to us, right?
Yep, that's right.
So this story that we're reading is based off of that, but I think it's a much more effective treatment.
Oh yeah, it's way better and way different.
It's way different. What did Lovecraft have to say about the story?
He says, in the present generation, German horror fiction is most notably represented by Hans Heinz Urs, who brings to bear on his dark conceptions and effective knowledge of modern psychology. Novels like The Sorcerer's Apprentice and Alron, and short stories like The Spider contain distinctive qualities which raise them to a classic level.
Mm-hmm. I agree, HP.
Me too.
I'm glad to agree with him on something because I feel a little bad calling him stupid last week.
Well, he can be stupid at times.
He had it coming, but he's absolutely right about this one. Now, I haven't heard of this author before, and we haven't covered him on the show.
No, we haven't talked about him before. So Hans Heinz Urs was born in 1871 in Germany. He's a German guy. Mm-hmm. He was a poet at an early age, and he actually got some recognition when he was 17 years old for writing a poem that was published in the paper about the death of Frederick III. He tried to enlist in the army, but he couldn't because he had eye problems. He was myopic. And I mean that literally.
In actuality, he was myopic. I thought maybe his eyes were invisible and that's why they wouldn't let him in. But
no!
No.
He didn't really become a professional writer until he was about 30. He got a book published. It was called A Book of Fables. Mm-hmm. He then lived in New York for a bit during the First World War. He was a big proponent of the U.S. not getting involved with the World War and helping Britain. He was a bit of a German nationalist. I guess it's okay to say that. He got caught. He was busted helping German Americans who were going to fight over in Germany during the war by somehow aiding them in making fake passports, because obviously they weren't being allowed to go over and help fight in the war.
So he got arrested for propaganda? Is that?
Yeah, he got arrested in 1918 for being an active propagandist. I'm not sure exactly what that means. Mm-hmm. He went into an internment camp and was released in 1921 when he moved back to Germany. And I bet you can see where this is going.
Yeah, what was happening in Germany that he got interested in?
The Nazi Party!
Yay!
But check this out, to his credit, he got out of the Nazi Party pretty quick because he didn't like the way that they treated Jewish people. He was so not into anti-Semitism.
I think he had strong Jewish female characters in his work, too, in his writing, yeah.
He did, yeah. And he was also pro-homosexual,
Well, you said he's pro-homosexual. I think he was an amateur homosexual. Yeah.
Yes, he was amateur. He was homosexual, or at least he had homosexual relationships. He might have even been married to a woman who was Jewish. So that shows you that he had a lot of differing viewpoints from the Nazi party, and he might not be totally on board with them.
Right.
So he voiced his concerns and said, hey, you know what? I don't think this is cool, what we're doing to the Jews and what we're doing to the gays. So we should stop. And they said, oh, that's what you think? Guess what? You are not our kind of person. So we're going to ban all your books and we're going to seize all your assets. Haha, we're Nazis. That happened in 1934. So during the whole war, he was kind of in trouble. But by 43, he got his last book published because unfortunately he died later that year of tuberculosis.
Interesting guy. I love to hear those stories of what people did or didn't do when Hitler was rising to power. You know, not everybody fell in lockstep. Not everybody fell in line.
Of course not.
I like that we decided to do a grab bag of stories this month. Last week it was super racist, and then this week we've got a Nazi author. You know, it's like somebody wrote in and they were like, is this Uncomfortable August? Is that what this month is going to be called? I think that's appropriate.
Well, you know, I'm not uncomfortable with him. I think he was a pretty good guy and his work's pretty awesome.
Yeah. So this is a story that Lovecraft referred to specifically, The Spider.
Yes.
And I think it's been anthologized a lot.
It was anthologized a lot because it was one of the first stories that he had translated into English. So it made it into a ton of anthologies. And it was originally written in 1915.
Well, I was expecting a giant spider. I didn't quite get that, but the story does play out in an interesting way. So let's talk about it.
The story starts off with our protagonist, a medical student named Richard Brackquimall. I think that's how it's pronounced.
I'm just going to Americanize it and say Brackmont.
Now, our protagonist is staying at a hotel in Paris. Three guys have died there over the last few weeks, all suicides, all by using the curtain line around their necks and then slowly leaning over so that their knees are just hanging off the floor.
Right. As we heard in that opening, it's as a sign of the great discipline the suicide must have exercised in carrying out his design. So you would think that in that last moment, your body wouldn't even let you do this. The fact that just by putting your feet on the ground, you could save yourself.
Yeah.
But these people didn't do it. I just listened to a radio show about a guy who jumped off a bridge and said, as soon as he was going through the air, he went, why did I do this? I shouldn't have done this.
Oh, jeez.
This was idiotic, and was rescued out of the water. And I wonder how many suicides that probably happens. It seems like your body just has got to be doing everything in its power to stop you from killing yourself. And for somebody to hang themselves with the ability to rescue themselves is really macabre.
Macabre and probably unnatural.
Yes.
The first guy to do this was a Swiss businessman. All the deaths happened on a Friday between 5 and 6 p.m. Now, this Swiss guy, he was married, he had kids, he seemed to be a happy dude, by all accounts, had a good life. Everyone was totally surprised that he had killed himself. The second guy that did this was an artist. His name was Karl Kraus. He was a high-wire cyclist from the circus. He moved into the room the following week. He killed himself that Friday. Same thing as the other guy. Again, happy, no reason why he would kill himself.
No, when I heard he was a high wire cyclist from the circus, my first thought was hipster. He's probably got, you know, some kind of Pringles mustache and you know, makes his own cheese or something. But I hate the term hipster because I can't seem to nail down what that really means. And it feels like it's just an angry thing that people say because they don't like it when people are trying too hard at anything. It seems a little bitter to me, hipster.
Okay.
Hipsters, as I see, it's always somebody who they've tried to put together an outfit, or they're brewing their own beer, or they're riding a unicycle, or they got a fixie bike. There's always effort attached to it, I feel.
Sure.
Even if they've grown the giant mustache and are waxing it. This is something that somebody's trying at. And everybody I hear derisively call hipsters hipsters seems angry that somebody's trying to do something. So I have kind of a reflexive punk reaction to it, which is just shut up. Go live your normal life. Wear your polo shirts and shut up if somebody's trying something different, you know?
Well, I think that might be the beef that some people have with hipsters, is that hipsters think that they're doing something different, but they're really not doing anything that different because there's already a bunch of people doing what they're doing.
Yeah, which I get. And I like to look, I'll make fun of any segment of society. It's one of those things. I don't understand why people are so angry about it, though.
Yeah, I don't know why you would get angry.
Maybe that's because I'm older and I think people around our age are starting to grow the kids these days mentality.
Yep, we're in our 40s now.
It's inevitable, you know? So it's this kind of like anger towards a younger generation. I don't understand what they're doing with their iMacs and their mustaches.
Well, you know, speaking full disclosure here, as a guy who just grew a handlebar mustache for the short film Pickman's Guest.
When can we expect Pickman's guest?
In a couple of weeks, in case you haven't heard. Lackey and Johnson are back again, and we're doing our take on Pickman's model, which is called Pickman's Guest. I will have a funny mustache in there. I'm playing Pickman with a funny mustache. Greg Johnson is playing Bosworth, who was mentioned in the story. He too will have outrageous facial hair. Because as you know, Chad, Greg and I like to be as faithful to the original source material as we possibly can.
I'm sure. Well, I'm looking forward to seeing that because I loved the last two. Did anybody give you any crap for growing that mustache?
No, the opposite, actually. Everybody said it looked really great. And I, of course, shaved it off immediately afterwards because I was a little annoyed with it. When I saw myself in pictures from the shoot, I was like, man, I look pretty good with that mustache. So maybe I'll grow it back. The end. That's my story.
Well, so the owner of this hotel, what's her name?
The proprietor of the hotel is Madame Dubinet. First guy died. Not a big deal. She was cool with it.
I don't know if she was cool with it, but it didn't affect her business too much.
Right, of course. She's not a monster. But when the second death hit, that really freaked out her business because everybody cleared out. One suicide, not a big deal. Two suicides, same room, same way. Same time, people are thinking this place is haunted. Boom, they're out of there. Now, she doesn't know what to do because her business is really hurting. So she goes and finds this police friend of hers, this guy Charles, tells him what the situation is. He doesn't buy all the supernatural BS. So he's like, oh, no, I'll go check it out. I know what's up. Chuck is a former military man, and then he became a police officer. So stayed there for a week. He checked in with the police every morning and every evening. Nothing strange to report. On Wednesday, he acted like he might be onto something. He didn't go into any specifics on it. Friday, during the day, he was acting strangely, saying only that the window had some attractive power, but he felt like it had nothing to do with the suicides. Of course, later that night, he was found hung on the curtain cord, same way, same time of death, same day of the week.
So would you, at this point, take on this investigation after the third death? If somebody were going to pay you for it, would you go stay in that room?
Yeah. Yeah, I think I'd do it.
What would be your setup? How would you protect yourself?
Well, first, I wouldn't go in there alone, number one. But two, if it seems people have to be at this window to do this thing, then I would have handcuffed myself to, you know, the radiator or something so I couldn't get to the window.
That's pretty smart.
I would also make sure the accomplice was handcuffed to something as well so that they couldn't get out. Actually, I wouldn't even have them in the room. That would make sense so that they couldn't be influenced by it. So I would have my accomplice handcuff me so I can't get out myself. They would leave and they just need to be gone for that time period, you know, on that Friday, 5 to 6. And then hopefully I would have some insight as to why these guys killed themselves.
Yeah, yeah. I like the idea that nobody else came up with, which is have a second person stay there.
I know.
Would have solved all of this stuff. My favorite character in the story is actually, there's a teacher who is staying in room 16 of this place. Everybody's moved out, but this guy, he took advantage of the occasion to have his rent reduced by a third. I applaud that.
All right, yeah.
That guy, that's the smartest guy in the story.
Yeah, I'm with that guy too, because it only happened in this one room.
Yeah.
At this very specific time and date. In fact, I wouldn't even mind renting that room out. I would just make sure I wasn't there on Fridays.
Yeah, exactly.
In fact, you could even be there on Fridays. You just have to make sure you're not in the room between 5 and 6.
There you go. I would definitely stay in a room that was haunting adjacent. If I got a reduction in my rent.
Heck yeah.
Also, an opera singer bought this cord that people have been hanging themselves with. It's interesting that there were probably a lot of people who wanted to get this red curtain cord. It says that the opera singer paid 200 francs for it, saying it would bring her luck. I don't understand that reasoning. Three people have hung themselves with this cord, but it's going to bring her luck.
Well, maybe since it was used as a murder weapon, it's all charged up now. You know, it's got like a positive charge to do other awesome things, like a cursed item in Friday the 13th, the series.
I don't know.
Or just people are morbid that way. I don't know.
You say murder weapons. That would be my suspicion of what's going on. That somebody is sneaking in and doing this to the people.
Yeah, of course. I would think there has to be a logical explanation to it. And somebody murdering them, maybe chloroforming them and then hanging them there to kill them. Who knows? But that's what I would think. This made the papers, but it didn't make front page. There was too much other news going on at the time.
Yeah, there's too much says there were disorders in the Balkans, bank crashes in New York, the King and Queen of England were visiting, you know, so it only gets a little bit of page width in the paper.
And it's this newspaper article that attracts our protagonist, Dick. Now, there is a detail that is left out of the newspaper that when these bodies were found, a big black spider crawled out of their mouths.
Right. And it turns out that spider had been around every time that somebody committed suicide. This story, and at this point, I was like, this is a lot better than The Invisible Eye.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I do miss the quirkiness of the cross-dressing from the other story. But,
yeah, me too.
But this creepy spider climbing out of the mouth, it got me, even though that's almost cliche to have a bug climb out of somebody's mouth. It still kind of got me when I read that.
Well, yeah, they use it because it's so effective. They recently used it on Stranger Things, if you recall.
They did.
2 weeks after Chuck's death, that's when Richard moves in. Richard kept a detailed diary of his experiences, and that is what most of the story is. It's just a reading of his diary. So Monday, February 28th, Rich seems to be pretty pleased with himself. He admits in his journal that he kind of tricked the police. Lots of people wanted access to this room. People think they could crack the case, or maybe they were charlatans, or they were just into haunted stuff. Whatever it was, Dick was the one that got in.
I really like that, because often in these stories that we read, once something is reputed to be haunted, everybody shuns it. In this story, people are clamoring to be in there.
Yeah.
And I think that's a little closer to reality. The fact that the opera singer buys the cord that people hung themselves with, the fact that he had to come up with a strategy to get to stay in the room because so many people wanted to stay in the room.
Yeah.
That seems a little realer to me. Anything that would have a macabre association with it, people would immediately want to go in and check it out. So I thought that was interesting. What's kind of funny is that the way that he got away with tricking the police is just by telling them, I have a plan.
Yep.
That was his trick. He didn't even really have to explain the plan.
Nope, not at all. I actually really worry about the police in Paris. They don't seem to be too with it.
Yeah, none of the police seem too sharp here. And I'm happy one of my favorite verbs gets used because the protagonist says he bamboozled them.
Yeah.
Which I always like.
So Dick goes to Madame Debonnet and she sends him to the police. The police just blow him off for almost a week and says, you know, if you actually have a plan of figuring this case out, then we'll listen. So then if he says, oh, yeah, I've got a plan. You've got the plan? We're listening.
Yeah.
So since he doesn't really have a plan, he has to sort of fast talk the inspector. So he just starts pointing out facts about the case. He says, you know, these all happen on Friday at right around 5 or 6 o'clock, which is the occult hour. The last week in the Jewish calendar, the day that Christ died and descended into hell. He says, Inspector, you really need to look into the book of Revelations.
Yeah, that's just his bull roar. It doesn't really have anything to do with what actually happened there, but it sounds like he has some insight.
Yeah, totally. But he doesn't have any. He's just making stuff up as he goes. As he's feeding him this line of bull, the inspector is nodding and scratching his chin and saying, yeah, you know what? This is a great idea. We're going to not only give you access to the place, but we're going to pay for it and your meals.
Bamboozling at its finest.
And on top of this, the inspector has a phone line installed into that room that directly goes from that room to the police station.
Yeah, so he's got a little bat phone in there.
So Wednesday, March 2nd, nothing so far. He ends up talking to the madame out of boredom, really. She's there, but she's got her own theory. The first guy, she doesn't know anything about him. But the second guy, the artist, she thinks that he had a bad love affair that didn't end well. The cop, he just killed himself to annoy her.
Just to annoy her, yeah. She says, I know what'll get her goat. I'll kill myself.
Zing. Thursday, nothing again. He talks to the cop twice a day on the line that they set up. On Friday, he gets this great meal with champagne. He says, I eat uncommonly well at noon. The landlady brought me half a bottle of champagne. It seemed a meal for a condemned man.
They feed him up real well because they figure he's probably going to hang himself later in the day.
So he writes as he sits at his table. It's getting to be that hour. He's got a revolver that the cops gave him right next to him. And it's 6 o'clock and he's fine. And he admits that he felt a bit of a compulsion to go to the window, but it was for a different reason. And the inspector called him every 10 minutes to check in on him anyway. It's all good. And of course, Madame D is just stoked.
He cracked the case. He made it through.
Well, he didn't crack the case.
Well, he doesn't know why people did what they did.
Yeah, but. Well, the inspector's kind of unhappy because he wanted some answers. And this doesn't really give him any answers. Of course, he's happy he's alive. But Dick thinks that the police maybe missed something, that there is some sort of common element between these three victims, why they all came to this place and why they all died the same way.
Right.
So Wednesday the 9th, he is all about Claire Monda. This is a lady that lives across the street from him, and he sees her through his window. He's become obsessed with her. He doesn't know if Claire Monda is actually her name, but it's just the name he calls her because, you know, he's never actually talked to this woman.
That's got to be her name. He thinks, if I went and I knocked on her door and she answered, I'm sure she would tell me that her name is Claire Monda. I don't know why he's fixated on that name. I looked it up. If you do an image search on Claire Monda, it's all goth stuff. This is as goth a name as it gets. In German, the meaning of the name is brilliant protectress, which is a little ironic considering what Claire Monda is about to do to him.
She lives in a flat across the street, and he sees into her flat through his window, into her window. She has long, dark hair, pale skin. She's dressed all in black with black gloves. Mm-hmm. And she just sits there in the room using this old-fashioned spindle made of ivory.
Yeah.
Now, she's working there all day, but when night comes, he can't see her anymore, so she's just kind of gone.
She either is leaving or she's just sitting there in the dark.
And as a reader here, you kind of know what's going on.
That's the only issue with this story. It's telegraphed. I mean, you know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
So you kind of want it to just happen. But
yeah,
it is interesting the way it slowly unfolds.
Now, Dick is pleased because she saw him looking at her and she gave him a little nod. And he's like, yeah, all right, I got a nod. I'm stoked. So we go to Thursday the 10th. He has been studying his medical books, but he's distracted because he's pretty into Claramonda.
Yeah.
He has trouble sleeping. He can't stop thinking about her. And then he goes to the window to check her out, and she's just sitting there with her hands on her lap, just kind of being creepy, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. So he goes to the blinds to adjust them so that he can get a better look at her. And as he looks up at her, she is also adjusting her blinds. They're doing the exact same thing. They exchange smiles.
So this mimicry starts happening, this mm-hmm. mirror game, which was how it was in the other story that we read.
Yeah.
The Invisible Eye. It was all about let's copy what the other person is doing.
The next entry is from Saturday the 12th. So what happened on Friday?
Well, you got through it.
Yes, of course. Claramonda smiles, waves and nods at him from time to time. And around 6 on Friday, he decided just to plant himself in his chair and not move. He admits that he wanted to go to the window to see Claramonda, but you know, he's like, I can't do it. There's some sort of self-preservation that wins out, and he just stays in the chair.
Yeah.
After 6 o'clock, he still feels this compulsion. So he gets up and he goes over the window to see if he can see her. Now, again, it's dark. So he's surprised that she is actually standing right in the window and he could see her. And they lock eyes for a second. And just then the phone rings. And, oh, Dick is so angry because he was interrupted.
Yeah. You can feel the obsession starting to,
yeah,
to really set in with him.
Yeah.
All he really wants to do is look at and think about Claramonda.
Now, of course, the madam is stoked, but the inspector, he wants answers and he's not getting them. So Dick says, you know, I'm on the trail of something. He's not.
Right.
But he wants to keep getting free room and board, mostly to keep looking at Claramonda. Now, he's trying to stalk her a bit, but she never leaves. He's never seen her on the street or anywhere else besides the room from the window. He tries to go back to his studies, but he can't. He can only think about Claramonda.
Yes.
Sunday the 13th, he watches some spider porn, live sex acts, then murder.
What?
Well, actually, it's just a female spider in her web. This male spider approaches. She allows him to come in. They mate. Mm-hmm. And then as he's getting ready to leave, she kills him, yeah, wraps him up in the web, eats him.
Right. And it's apparently, this is what's going to happen in the story in a way.
Some heavy foreshadowing.
She lures the male spider in, and then when he's like, see you, baby, that was fun, but I gotta go. He's a little like Shaft. But when he's trying to take off, she grabs him and drinks his blood.
Monday the 14th, Claramonda and Dick are doing this strange game together. In some flirty way, they are mirroring each other's movements, and they do this a lot.
And of course, to me, it's comical. I mean, there's just, once people start doing that, it just makes me think, like, what are they doing exactly? Is he breakdancing a little bit and then she's doing it? Or like, it's kind of like that story we read where the person was doing passes. I mean, I don't understand what the actual movements are that she's mirroring.
They're pop locking.
They're pop locking. I think that's right.
Wednesday the 16th, he thinks about going over and talking to her, but he feels a little afraid. Maybe he's built this up and it'll be something that it's not, but what? And also the fear just kind of keeps him from taking things further.
Yeah, I don't know. It's obviously something mystical is going on because there's no reason he wouldn't just walk across the street and go knock on her door. He never does this, though.
Thursday, he realizes he doesn't talk to anyone. He just stays in his room and plays this weird window game with this woman.
Yeah, I no longer laugh at the trick I played the inspector. His whole plan thing and self-congratulation about getting into this room is starting to fade away because he's realizing that he's slowly going insane, but he can't stop himself.
Friday the 18th, it's go time, and Dick is realizing he has some fear of Claramonda.
Yeah.
He really, really wants to go to the window and play his little game with Claramonda, but he keeps thinking of the dead men in the window and it freaks him out.
Yeah.
And also he knows he doesn't want to hang himself. He just wants to see her. Then he's about to get up. The phone rings. He answers it and it's the inspector and he just says, come at once. And he screams.
Right.
He hangs up the phone. He goes over, has himself a cup of water. And the inspector shows up. He's like, what happened? What's going on? And he says, I don't want to talk about it yet, but I'm getting to the bottom of something.
He also dissembles a little bit, right? I mean, he says, oh, it wasn't that big of a deal. I'm sorry I called you. Says, strangely enough, I was lying to him.
Yep.
I myself had the feeling that I was telling the truth. And even now, against my will, I have that same conviction. He couldn't help but lie to the inspector.
Who is this inspector?
Yeah, he's a terrible inspector.
He's horrible. He goes, oh, you called me. There's a scream. A bunch of guys have killed themselves. You act weird. Okay, why don't you stay here another week? What?
The other thing about the inspector that I like, he goes, so you called and you screamed, but now you're telling me that there's nothing going on. Nothing suspicious about that at all. How about we go out and party? I mean, because that's what the inspector wants to do. Yes. On Saturday, he comes by and he says, let's go. You got to get out of here. We drank a lot. We laughed and we chatted. So that's what that's the detective work this inspector does, is he just gets people out to go drink with him.
I think this answers my question about what kind of inspector this guy is.
But when our protagonist gets back to the room and sees Claramonda, he can tell that she's a little mad about him having left.
Yeah,
she
gives him a little naughty, shaky finger.
Yeah.
But she forgives him.
She does.
She says, oh, right, you know, let's play a little game. And they play all day. And they also play Sunday through Tuesday, all day. Wednesday, he admits he's in love with her.
Mm-hmm.
It's strange, but he's totally in love with her. Yet,
of course,
he's kind of scared of her. But why? Thursday, he comes to the terrible realization that he's not playing the game with her. She is making him do the stuff.
Yeah, it's not that he's doing moves and she's mirroring it, although it's felt that way to him. That's not actually what's happening. He's doing what she does.
He got excited about doing this with her. So the night before, he wrote down some cool moves. You know, some special pop locks he was going to do.
Helicopter, yeah.
And the next day, when they went to go do their little game, at the end of the day, he realized that he didn't do any of his moves. He only did what she wanted him to do.
Yeah, he didn't do any. I had not made use of a single one of my patterns. He didn't do any of the moves that he'd written down. And this story does take a while to get to the climax, and I wish it would speed up a little bit. Except in this case, I wish there was a ton of description about what the moves were. I just want to know. Some jazz hands, a little tap dance. Does he do a little pelvic thrust? I mean, what's going on here?
I wish it were all of the above. But anyway, he thinks about leaving, but he just can't. He doesn't want to run off because he wants answers to the mystery. He puts his hands in his pockets to try and resist her. It works for a while, but it is really, really hard. And eventually he gives in.
Yeah.
Because he just wants to make her happy.
Yeah, I think it's that exact thing that happens a lot in these type of stories where people are writing in their diary where they're struggling to write it, and then you know, I was expecting somebody to pull them away, and you know, and there's somebody coming through the door, right? You know, it's that kind of thing.
So Friday comes and he is just under her power. He looks out the window and he sees her pick up a phone.
Yeah, she's got the same phone that he's got, and she lifts it up as part of the game and cuts the cord. It's pretty insidious. So he does the same thing.
And then she reaches over, grabs the curtain cord, and ties it into a noose. He's trying to write this stuff down as it's happening, but he feels the strong compulsion to do exactly as she's doing. He does it and then goes back to writing again. He's fighting for control. And this goes on and on for a while. His writing gets more sporadic. He begins trying to think of anything that he can do to not do what she wants him to do. So he just begins writing his name over and over again.
But you have that dash where, you know, he's, I can't go on. No, I must look at her. Richard Brackmont. No, no more. Richard Brack. And that's as far as his journal goes.
The inspector of the Ninth Precinct, after repeated and vain efforts to telephone Richard, arrived at the Hotel Stevens at 6:05. He found the body of the student, Richard Brackmont, hanging from the crossbar of the window in room number 7, in the same position as each of his 3 predecessors. The expression on the student's face, however, was different, reflecting an appalling fear. Brackmont's eyes were wide open and bulging from their sockets. His lips were drawn into a rictus, and his jaws were clamped together. A huge black spider, whose body was dotted with purple spots, lay crushed and nearly bitten in two between his teeth. On the table, there lay the student's journal. The inspector read it, and went immediately to investigate the house across the street. What he learned was that the second floor of that building had not been lived in for many months.
Dun, dun, dun.
Huh. Well, I feel like there's kind of an implication here. Maybe there isn't. Maybe it's just a weird story.
What implication? What do you say? Go ahead.
Well, I think that the spider that was crawling out of people's mouths was actually maybe making the manifestation appear in the window that was hypnotizing him.
So the spider's pulling all the strings.
Yeah, because somehow at the end of it, he had control enough to bite down and crunch the spider and kill it. If that was important to him, if he was able to force his will to do that, then there must be some significance to it.
Yeah, the only thing that would tell us whether that's true or not would be if we had a sequel to this. What happened to the next person who stayed in that room?
Yeah.
If they were fine, then yeah, you're right. He managed to stop the menace by biting the spider in half. But I don't know. It is just a weird thing. The spider might also just be, you know, a detail.
Like it might have had nothing really to do with it. Who knows? This is very much a weird tale. It's not a ghost story. I don't see any ghostly things going on.
It might be a ghost story, but yeah, we don't have enough. We don't know any backstory on this Claramonda. So is it just a malevolent manifestation of some kind? Why is it convincing people to kill themselves? And the whole idea of obsession and driving yourself to your own death because you can't stop doing something.
Yeah.
Is an interesting thing that's running through this. I really liked the story. It was a,
I did too.
It was a good read.
It went on a little long at the end.
Yeah.
But it felt very modern for 1915. So next week ends our month of potpourri, and we are going to take something kind of off the beaten path, something that Lovecraft never has read before, a story by author Jack Vance. Have you heard of him before?
I haven't heard of Jack Vance, no. It was so, but you have, right?
Oh, yes. He was very influential on lots of modern sci-fi, fantasy, all that stuff, even role-playing games. So I think we should check him out.
Okay.
The story we're going to cover is called Green Magic.
Green Magic. All right. That sounds good. It's a little pot-smoking sounding, but perhaps it won't be about that. I'm looking forward to checking it out and knowing who this Jack Vance guy is. But that's all we have for this week on our coverage of The Spider. Hope you enjoyed the story.
I want to thank Caleb Hovern for rocking and rolling the readings.
Yes, you are the best. And we'll be back with Green Magic. This has been the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and you can find us at hppodcraft.com.
hppodcraft.com.